This is not designed to be a test of your movie knowledge or a trivia question, but the cadets in this film were legendary. You had the youthful voiced Hooks, a petite young woman. You had the deep voiced and man who could lift a car, Hightower. You had Tackleberry, whose gun blast would demolish the targets to smithereens. Not a bullet hole, but blow the whole thing up. You had the calm and seemingly in control cadet played by Steve Guttenberg. These cadets formed the core of the 1984 classic comedy Police Academy. It was a legendary film. I watched it over and over and over and over and over and over again with my neighbor Aaron Hodgin. And the story was one for the ages. It was a crime-ridden city in America that needed more police protection. So the mayor hatched a plan, and it would be that anybody could become a police officer. All you had to do is go through this basic academy. And so that developed this collection of misfits and bozos that were known as the cadets in Police Academy. And the mayor's plan comes out of total left field, doesn't it? Does anybody assemble a team based on the collection of misfits and bozos? No one builds a team like that where everyone's just welcome to join and be a part of it. Think back to recess in elementary school, and there were always the kids that got picked first, and there were the kids that got sort of assigned to a team that were sort of the remainders, if you will. There's always an order. And it's no different in the boardroom than it is in the recess field, right? In business school, they talk about succession planning. It's how you identify a pool of applicants who you believe possess 3 to 5 traits that are important to this position, whether it's the CEO or a vice president. And then with these applicants, you then feather increased opportunities to them and see how they do, observe and see how they interact and see what develops. In other words, it all becomes merit-based. And this is what makes the world go around and around and around. It's what New York Times columnist David Brooks refers to as resume virtues. It are the things that fill out our CV, fill out our resumes. It's the skills that we bring into the marketplace. Jesus in the gospel today is beginning to put together his team and his people. And his approach is not the world's approach. It is rather the police academy approach to assembling a team. He doesn't use Michael Porter's strategic business acumen. Instead, he just says, come to me and follow. Now, we'll take a break from this sermon for a second and talk about St. Ignatius. St. Ignatius is a legendary church leader and father almost, and he had a spiritual method for reading scripture. It was as follows. You read the text one time, very slowly, and you wait for that moment that something jumps out at you. It may be a person, it might be a thing, it might be something that you even assume is going on, such as like a bystander that's not mentioned in the text. And once you have your hold on whatever it is, a person or even a place or a thing, then you then visualize the text as if you're that person or thing. So you would then read back through the text as if you were the boat or as if you were in the marketplace watching these fishermen at work. I have a friend named Hugh Wilson who died last week, and in the course of his last few years, he worked on a book. And the book was the unpublished letters from Peter to his mother-in-law. So it is, there's not true letters out there, just so everybody knows. But he invented, what would it be like, what would Peter write to his Jewish mother-in-law, and what would be their relationship? What would she then write back to him? And so he used this Ignatian form of reading scripture to become Peter, and then also to be the mother-in-law. And he describes today's gospel using this form. And this is Peter writing to his mother-in-law. "Mom, we were fishing near the shoreline down by Job's spring, when what do we see walking the shoreline but Jesus of Nazareth, the mysterious stranger we met at John's camp on the Jordan a few weeks back. So we rode in, and he says to us, like he's known us forever, 'Follow me.' The next thing I know, and Andrew's right with me, we parked the boat, and we're following him, just like we had known him forever. Later that night, Andrew asks, 'So where have you been since we last saw you?' He responded, 'Wrestling with the devil in the desert.' Then we both got real quiet for a while. Finally, I piped up, 'Well, who won?' And he just makes this little smile and tells us that from now on, we will be fishers of men." "What does that even mean, Mom? Like slave catchers? Andrew and I aren't doing that, yet we continue to follow this guy." And then we see a boat putting out a trammel net about 60 feet offshore, and it's old man Zebedee and his sons, James and young John. And Jesus cups his mouth and yells to the brothers. And with that, the two of them jump overboard and start swimming in. Now, the old man Zebedee went crazy. He was yelling and cursing up a storm, as you might imagine. The sons of Zebedee came out of the water, and Jesus started walking inland with the two sets of brothers following him like mindless moths chasing a flame. It just makes no sense at all. I know, Mom. I don't know what to do with it." Jesus starts to build his team today amongst the uneducated and ordinary fishermen, as they're described in the book of Acts. From a small town of every town, USA, Galilee was the melting pot. It was nothing, there was no power center in Galilee. It was just simply where people went, where the fishermen, where those that were just living their day-in, day-out life went. There was no hub of Pharisees or scribes or Roman governors in a place like Galilee. In other words, Jesus didn't go to the bishop's office to start building his team, nor did he go to Cambridge, nor did he go to Washington, D.C., but he went to some place like Fincastle or Buchanan or Roanoke, or the place where people just lived and worked. He went into the world and found these people, James and John and Simon, Peter and Andrew, and disregarded all measurements of the world as he began to create his followers and his team. Because the logic of the gospel is counter to the merit-based system of our lives. And this is what my friend Hugh is getting at when he writes at the end of that short story. It makes no sense at all. It doesn't make any sense. It's why St. Paul tells us, "For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved, it is the power of God." And so why is the foolishness, this backwards idea, so life-giving? It's so life-giving because it takes the shackles off of our lives. We can jump out of the boat, whatever metaphoric boat we're in, wherever we feel constrained in by the laws and the rules of the world. We can jump out of it. We can experience something new and more life-giving. We can lay down our weary tune, to quote Bob Dylan, and then we can just laugh. We can make snowmen that actually go to sleep and not stand upright. We can just enjoy life, and we can laugh at this absurdity. Because it is absurd if we begin to think about that God, who created the world, came as an ordinary man, Jesus Christ, and then began to assemble his team by grabbing a bunch of fishermen and sort of call it out, come on, guys, let's go. And then they just went. That just doesn't happen in our real life. But yet nothing's ever been more real in the world, because God's purpose is so clear to show us once and for all that we are loved without condition, without regard to merit or production or any of the world's standards of accomplishment, that we are loved unconditionally and without reservation. David Brooks describes this type of love as seen through Dorothy Day in his book, The Road to Character. He describes it as the kind of love that de-centers the self. The kind of love that de-centers the self. This is why Jesus says to you and to me that to lose your life is to gain your life. To give up your life is to actually receive life and receive it abundantly. And this is the good news of the gospel, is that Jesus has come for each of us, just like he came for Andrew and Peter and the sons of that old man Zebedee. He's coming for us to give us grace upon grace, to give us the amazing grace, the love of God. And in this absurdity, in this humorous account of thinking about God is a person calling some fishermen, the upside down nature of the gospel, we see the actual truth that God's ways are not our ways. And knowing that is the good news of the gospel, because that's to know that it's true. I'll close with my friend Hugh Wilson again. Hugh incidentally wrote and directed Police Academy. And he wrote later in his book this message from Peter to his mother-in-law describing this scene in the gospel. Peter writes, Peter says, "It doesn't make any sense at all." Later that night, we still didn't make sense of any of this, but yet as the four of us, me and Andrew and John and James, are sitting around the campfire, I realized that all of us were thinking that this was the most important moment of our lives.
Stand together and renew our faith in the reading of the Nicene Creed, which can be found on page 358 of the Book of Common Prayer. We believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, maker of heaven and earth.